Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 39, Eusebius and His Contemporaries. In this episode, we finally come to the end of our 3rd century narrative, as we discuss the prominent Christians who lived at the tail end of the little piece of the church. But before diving into our main topic, we need to reorient ourselves to the wider political context. The last Roman emperor we discussed was Aurelian, who was assassinated in the autumn of 275, just as he was gearing up to launch a new persecution of Christians. Following the murder of the unconquered restorer of the world were two undistinguished Augusti, Tacitus and later his brother Florianus. Their brief reigns, the details of which do not concern us here, quickly gave way to the ascension of another Illyrian soldier emperor, Probus, in 276. Probus built upon the foundation laid by Aurelian for the recovery of the empire. While he variously campaigned along the major frontiers, Probus was also able to have his soldiers engage in public works projects, a sign that the crisis of the 3rd century was coming to an end. But like so many before him, Probus was struck down by his own troops. Although the Persian king Bahram II, whom we discussed a couple episodes ago, had made peace with Rome, the desire to avenge Valerian and restore Roman honor still remained. Probus was likely planning to attack Persia when he was slain, just as Aurelian had been. The reasoning behind the murder was, although the Persian campaign was likely to still happen, Probus had been boasting of the peace he had achieved, and how soon Rome would no longer need her armies. Propaganda, to be sure, but the troops took this as a portent of unemployment. Probus was succeeded by Carus in 282, who was acclaimed Augustus by the troops following their slaying of his predecessor. He was joined in imperial rule by his sons Carinus and Numerian. While the older son remained in the west, Carus took Numerian with him on campaign against the Persians. He won an easy victory, sacking Ctesiphon and crossing the Tigris, as the Persians were currently busy on the eastern frontier of their empire. But then, a bolt of lightning struck Carus dead. Numerian interpreted this as a sign from the gods to end the campaign, which had overstepped the bounds of Roman expansion. But on the way home, Numerian died, and on November 20th, 284 AD, the army elevated to the rank of Augustus, in opposition to the still-alive Carinus, the captain of the imperial bodyguard, an Illyrian officer named Diocles, better known to us as Diocletian. With his ascension, the crisis of the 3rd century finally comes to an end. Diocletian defeated Carinus the following year, becoming sole Augustus. But he quickly discerned that the empire could no longer be governed by a single man. He would first establish an imperial colleague to rule the West, before eventually establishing a system of 4 emperors, a tetrarchy, to rule and protect the vast lands of the Roman Empire. The details of all this, however, we shall save for after the narrative break. As many of you no doubt know, we will have much more to say about Diocletian. For the events just related, see episodes 120 and 121 of Mike Duncan's The History of Rome. Now it is time to turn ourselves back to the Great Church. We'll begin our tour with Caesarea Maritima, the capital of Roman Palestine. Aside from a few accounts of martyrs, the last time we looked intently at the Church of Caesarea was back during our coverage of Origen. As you may remember, Origen had founded a Christian library and school which produced such great luminaries as Gregory Thaumaturgus. Since that time, the school and library had continued to thrive after the death of its founder. During the late 3rd century, it produced 2 men of note, the presbyter Pamphilus and his student and spiritual son Eusebius. Yes, that Eusebius. At long last, although we have frequently referenced his History of the Church, Eusebius has not yet made an appearance in our story, until now. Eusebius was born not long after 260, and so, like Antony, grew up during the little piece of the church ushered in by Gallienus. As a young man, he became the student and spiritual son of the presbyter Pamphilus of Caesarea. It is possible that Pamphilus may have even adopted Eusebius, who later took the name Pamphili in honor of his spiritual father. Together, the two men devoted themselves to Origen's legacy, the library and school of Caesarea, and defending the great scholar's theology from charges of heresy. Although we don't know much else about his early life, in time, we will come to know Eusebius quite well. His life and work forms the critical bridge between the Church of the Ante-Nicene/Pre-Constantinian era and the Church of the Christian Roman Empire, a momentous series of events which, through Eusebius, we will have a front-row seat to view from. But that is for another day. Over the course of his life, Eusebius composed many works of various kinds, including historical, apologetic, biblical, and theological books. Most of these were written during the titanic events of the early 4th century, but it's worth skipping ahead chronologically to discuss some of them here and now. I'll save discussion of Eusebius' apologetic and theological works for after the narrative break, where they are relevant to the events of the 4th century. Among his biblical works include the Onomasticon, a book on place names in the Bible. Not surprising, given that Eusebius was a native of Palestine. He also produced his own Gospel Canons, tables of the four Gospels, arranging all the material in chronological order, and placing synoptic accounts next to each other. In this work, Eusebius was following in the footsteps of Tatian's Diatessaron, and the Gospel Concordance of Ammonius of Alexandria. In a similar vein, Eusebius produced a work called Gospel Problems and Solutions, or, alternatively, Gospel Questions and Answers, in which he sought to explain the apparent contradictions in the evangelists' accounts. He also penned, like his beloved Origen before him, commentaries on the biblical books, in this case, the Psalms and Isaiah. Eusebius is best known for his historical works, which in time came to include the Chronicle and the Ecclesiastical History. Eusebius's Chronicle was amongst the earliest examples of what we might call a universal or global history. It consists of two components. First, a chronography, which cited a diverse array of ancient authors to establish royal chronologies for the civilizations of the ancient world. The second part includes the tables, which form a universal chronology of numbered years, with events both secular and biblical placed parallel with one another on the timeline. Essentially, a synchronization stretching from the age of the pharaohs and Mesopotamians through the period of the Greeks and Romans, all tabulated and paralleled with the events of the Old Testament and the early church. The final edition of the Chronicle extends down to the year 326 during the reign of Constantine. But of course, the most famous and important of all Eusebius's literary labors is his Ecclesiastical History, or History of the Church. Eusebius's history had no real precedent, and so was an innovation in ancient historical writing. In its current form, the work chronicles the history of the early church from the time of Christ to the year 324. Eusebius lists several themes he wishes to pursue in writing his history. First, his chronological framework, the succession of the major bishoprics from the apostles down to his own day, synchronized with the reigns of the Roman emperors. Second, the interior life of the early church, including its great luminaries, leaders, authors, and teachers. Third, the history of heresy and how orthodoxy has prevailed. Fourth, the disastrous history of the Jews following the death of Christ and the persecution of the apostles. And finally, the persecutions waged against the Christians and the heroic martyrs, and confessors who withstood such violence. Eusebius used these themes as the parameters for his history. He also used his history for an apologetic purpose, to demonstrate that Christianity, broadly defined as the religion that worships God and his Logos, is the primeval religion of all mankind. The first faith, which stretched back to Adam, down through the Old Testament prophets, and on into the church. Thus, for Eusebius, Christianity was not a novel religion, which was a constant critique of contemporary pagans, but the oldest of all faiths, the true religion or true philosophy, as Eusebius often describes it. The ecclesiastical history is composed of 10 books. The first 7 books form a fairly coherent narrative of the church, predominantly the Eastern Greek-speaking churches, down to the reign of Probus. Books 8 through 10 cover the contemporary era of Diocletian and Constantine. Book 1 deals with the life of Christ and is amongst the earliest sources for the legend of King Abgar of Edessa. Book 2 covers the era of the apostles from the reign of Tiberius up to the reign of Nero, including the beginning of the Jewish revolt. Book 3 covers the era between the reigns of Vespasian and Trajan, including Titus's destruction of Jerusalem, the reign of Domitian, the final days of the last apostles, and the early apostolic fathers. Book 4 covers the period from Trajan to Marcus Aurelius, including events like the Bar Kokhba War, the rise of Gnosticism, and the early apologists like Justin Martyr. The great attention paid to the Jewish wars against Rome, and in particular their failure, served to prove Eusebius' theme of divine retribution brought on the Jews following the rejection of Christ and his church. Book 5 covers the shortest amount of time, from Marcus Aurelius to Septimius Severus, and is highly coherent. The heresies of Marcion and Montanus, the Quartodeciman controversy, and the career of Irenaeus all receive great attention. Book 6, covering the era from Severus to Decius, introduces Eusebius' hero, Origen of Alexandria, to whom the author devotes much of his text. Origen then leaves the stage to another Alexandrian, Dionysius the Great. Dionysius' letter correspondence forms the backbone of the later part of Book 6 and much of Book 7, which covered the persecutions of Decius and Valerian. Book 7 then goes on to narrate the controversies over Novatian, Paul of Samosata, and the Manichees, before finally coming to Eusebius' own time in the reign of Probus, where Eusebius discusses the prominent churchmen of his day. Eusebius' work is invaluable, not only in that it is the sole narrative source for the earliest Christian centuries, but also because Eusebius excerpts, paraphrases, and discusses a large swath of early Christian literature that is often only preserved in his work. The Library of Caesarea allowed Eusebius to access such a variety of texts, and if it were not for Eusebius quoting them in his history, we would not possess copies of most of these works. On a personal note, reading Eusebius's church history was a key factor in inspiring me to undertake this podcast. I cannot recommend enough reading Eusebius's work for yourself. Not only do you get to read his church history, but by virtue of all the authors he quotes, you get introduced to a huge variety of voices from the early church. Having said all that, Eusebius was not a perfect historian, and his biases and errors are plentiful. While the Bishop of Caesarea has been sort of a companion of mine in writing these episodes, he is not always correct or accurate. Not by deceitfulness, but more so by omission coupled with his limitations as a historian. For one, Eusebius's history is almost exclusively a history of the Greek-speaking church in the Eastern Roman Empire. He knew, for instance, almost nothing of Tertullian and Cyprian's voluminous Latin works, let alone other minor Latin authors like Minucius Felix. The only place in the West he seemed to have had a decent amount of information about was the Church of Rome. Yet even here he was limited. For instance, he refers to Novatian as Novatus, confusing the schismatic antipope with the Carthaginian presbyter. Eusebius's knowledge of the events in Gaul, on the other hand, are even more circumscribed. He includes the Epistle of the Gallic Churches in Book 5, which is the primary source for the anti-Christian pogrom of circa 177 in Lugdunum. These Christians, such as Irenaeus, had a connection to the Greek-speaking churches of proconsular Asia, and it is by that connection which Eusebius probably was able to access such material. Turning east, Eusebius is even more limited in his knowledge. Aside from a few discussions of figures like King Abgar and Bardazin, Eusebius was pretty much blind to the entire history of the early Syriac-speaking Christians in the Parthian and Persian empires. Another major hindrance to Eusebius' reliability are two fundamentally anachronistic assumptions. First, because of the legality and respectability enjoyed by the church of the late 3rd century, Eusebius assumed that this had always been the case. He projected this back into the 1st and 2nd centuries. Persecution was then the abnormal policy, not the status quo. Hence, Eusebius failed to recognize the fundamental shift which occurred in Christianity's social standing during the age of the Severan emperors. In the 2nd century, Christians were charged with cannibalism and incest. In the 3rd century, a man like Origen could interact with the governor of Arabia or the women of the imperial family. Christianity only became a semi-socially respectable religion in the early 3rd century, but Eusebius failed to grasp this shift. Eusebius also incorrectly thought that Roman persecution was always a policy initiated by the emperors, and in particular, bad emperors. This creates the false impression that prior to Decius, persecution was always directed from the central government. As we know, prior to Decius, there was no empire-wide policy of active persecution. Rather, Christianity was illegal, and Christians were subject to local persecution from governors, pagans, and Jews at any potential time. Only on rare occasions, such as Trajan's rescript to Pliny, or Marcus Aurelius approving the execution of Christians in Lugdunum, did the emperors themselves become involved. This is clear from evidence like that of Tertullian, which again, Eusebius knew very little of. In terms of the history of the church itself, this assumption caused Eusebius to make chronological errors. Because he believed the reign of Antoninus Pius was peaceful for Christians, while Marcus Aurelius's reign was not, he placed the martyrdom of Polycarp a full decade later than when it actually occurred. Another example is Eusebius's conflation of two anti-Christian pogroms in Alexandria during the reign of Septimius Severus. The first of these included the martyrdom of Origen's father, while the second included the martyrdoms of Origen's students. We know these events were separated from each other by at least a few years because the names of the two prefects of Egypt named by Eusebius, Laetus and Aquila, were not successive to each other in the Egyptian prefecture. In fact, another prefect is securely attested between their tenures in office. But Eusebius believed Septimius Severus instituted an imperial persecution, and so combined these two local pogroms into one. Nevertheless, despite its shortcomings, Eusebius's ecclesiastical history will always remain among the most important sources for the early church. Having discussed Eusebius of Caesarea enough, we shall leave him for now and move on to some of his late 3rd century contemporaries, many of whom he discusses in Book 7 of his history. Heading north from Palestine, we enter Roman Syria. Among Eusebius's prominent contemporaries were men from the cities of Antioch and Laodicea. The first of these was Dorotheus of Antioch, a presbyter with a strong Greek education who had learned the Hebrew tongue and was able to exegete the Old Testament in its original language. Eusebius personally had the good fortune to listen to Dorotheus teach on the scriptures. Dorotheus had been a eunuch from birth. This, combined with his classical education, endeared him to the Emperor Diocletian, who appointed Dorotheus as manager of the Imperial Purple Dye Factory in Tyre, the same purple dye used to create the imperial cloaks of the emperors. Another major Antiochian was the presbyter Lucian, a somewhat shadowy figure given the later controversy surrounding his legacy. He is credited with founding the Theological School of Antioch, which, unlike Origen, emphasized a more historical and concrete interpretation of the Bible. Although an ardent biblical commentator, Lucian was not a prolific author. He was, however, well known as a theologian. Among his theological students were two men whose names will become well known to us once we get into the 4th century, Eusebius of Nicomedia and Arius of Alexandria. Yes, that Arius. In nearby Laodicea dwelt the two Alexandrian friends, Eusebius and Anatolius, whom we discussed a few episodes ago. Eusebius had attended the Council of Antioch, which dealt with Paul of Samosata. Shortly thereafter, the Christians of Laodicea made him their bishop. As for Anatolius, the bishop of Caesarea Maritima had intended for Anatolius to succeed him as bishop of the Palestinian capital, even going so far as to ordain him coadjutor bishop. But the Second Council of Antioch had summoned Anatolius, and not long after his old friend Eusebius fell asleep in the Lord, the people of Laodicea ordained Anatolius as their new bishop. Anatolius continued his career of Christian scholarship, even producing an improved computation for the date of Easter. Heading west into Anatolia, two bishops were quite prominent during the late 3rd century. The first of these was the Pontic bishop named Meletius Mellifluus, meaning the honey of Attica, an all-around Christian scholar and orator who Eusebius met when the Pontic bishop was in Palestine in the early 4th century. Concerning the second prominent bishop in Anatolia around this time, however, Eusebius is completely silent. Among the last anti-Nicene Greek fathers is Methodius, bishop of Olympus in Lycia, a well-known but shadowy figure in the historical record. The reason for Eusebius' omission of this major anti-Nicene author? Methodius was a major critic of Origen. Again, Eusebius' biases produce shortcomings in his work. Despite being best known as a critic of Origen, Methodius composed various writings, of which a serviceable amount survives. Among his works include the Symposium, a Platonic-style dialogue on virginity, in which 10 female Christian ascetics praise the virtues of virginity. Methodius appears to have been in contact, and perhaps managed, a household of proto-nuns. Remnants survive of a few other works of Methodius, including his anti-Originist On Free Will and On the Resurrection, which attack Origen's views on the infinite succession of worlds and the spiritual resurrection body. Methodius was clearly a reader of Origen, and even adopted some of his ideas, but in the end, he was a staunch critic, and for that reason, Eusebius excluded him from the pages of the ecclesiastical history. Heading westward, a certain Victorinus of Petovium, modern-day Ptu in Slovenia, produced a number of biblical commentaries in Latin, although only his commentary on Revelation survives. The commentary notably exhibits the old Kiliastic millenarian exegesis of the 1,000 years of Revelation 20. Our information about the rest of the Western churches is scanty for the late 3rd century. Little is mentioned of the bishops of Rome or Carthage, which seems to suggest an era of relative calm and peace. Although there are a few notable Latin Christians whose careers began at this time, their part in our story belongs to the events of the 4th century, and so we will leave the Western Church for the time being. Egypt, and Alexandria in particular, continued to operate as prime centers of Christianity. The death of Dionysius the Great in 264 led to a double succession, one to the episcopate and the other to the headship of the catechetical school. The succeeding bishop of Alexandria was one Maximus, a presbyter who had suffered along with Dionysius during the persecutions of Decius and Valerian. After 18 years, Maximus fell asleep in the Lord, and the throne of St. Mark passed to Theonas in 282. Theonas had to contend with two imperial usurpers against Diocletian based in Egypt, Domitianus and Achilleus, both of which were brutally suppressed. Nevertheless, a letter of Theonas addressed to a Christian imperial chamberlain shows the bishop maintained good relations with the imperial government. Indeed, in the letter, Theonas expresses his joy at the fact that Diocletian, though not yet a Christian, had enrolled so many believers among his imperial household. Oh, the dark and tragic irony. Fortunately for Theonas, he died in 300 before Diocletian reversed his attitude towards Christianity. Naturally, this was less fortunate for his successor, Peter, but that is for another day. Succeeding Dionysius to the catechetical school of Alexandria were two Origenist theologians. First, Theognostus, a major commentator of Origen's works, and second, Pierius, the teacher of Pamphilus of Caesarea, who was often referred to as Origen the Younger for his skills in teaching and his ascetic lifestyle. Both men were prolific authors and members of the Alexandrian Church. It would not be until the episcopate of Peter that Origenism would receive a major critic in the Church of Alexandria. The last Egyptian we shall mention briefly is a certain Hesychius. Possibly a native of Alexandria, Hesychius was a biblical scholar who produced an edition of the biblical Greek texts. Hesychius' recension was used in Egypt, but would later attract criticism for its perceived inaccuracies and additions. With that, we bring our discussion of Eusebius and his contemporaries to an end. We'll pause our narrative of the early church here, with the Christians of the Roman Empire still living in peace. As always, thank you for listening. This is our last episode before our narrative break episode series. We'll be covering everything from the Bible to theology to Christian practice to the church's relationship with non-Christians in the first three centuries. You can ask me just about anything, and I'll try to incorporate your questions into my research, or include them in the Q&A episode at the end. So don't forget to send in your questions and requests. You can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com, post a comment on the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, or post a comment on the blog site at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.